Okay.
Well, thank you, David. And thank you to all presenters for some great presentations. We're going to go ahead and get started with the question and answer session. While we're going through the question and answer session, I'm just going to bring up a slide on the Freight Peer-to-Peer program. I encourage you to take a look at the slide and visit the Freight Peer-to-Peer website for more information. I think, David, we'll start with questions for you since you just wrapped up and your presentation is fresh in everybody's minds. First question is, I heard a couple of years ago that the Class 1 railroads weren't so enamored of TIFIA and PABs, but preferred direct tax credits. To your knowledge, is this still the case?
Historically, that's absolutely correct. The railroads have been wary of accepting federal assistance with the implication that it might lead to perhaps some sort of federal assessment on their services. But I think that their thinking, from what I've seen, has evolved, and there's now greater receptivity to having the rail carriers take advantage of some of these new initiatives. They have been promoting investment tax credits as the tax code incentive, and we think that this alternative form, attaching the tax credits to debt rather than equity, is more cost effective from a federal viewpoint and would lead to greater investment overall.
To what extent do railroads, for example, take advantage of existing federal financial programs, such as the Railroad Revitalization Program? Aren't there existing finance programs?
Another good question. There is the Railroad Rehabilitation Improvement Financing Program, the RIF program, authorized at $35 billion under Safety Lou. I don't think a billion has been used yet, and it's been mostly for the smaller non-Class 1 carriers. I think, again, that's part of the evolving picture. Maybe other people have views on that, but I think the railroads are now seeing that important projects like CREATE can't necessarily happen on their own. They could benefit from a helping hand from DOT.
Okay. For freight infrastructure banks, what countries have these already been successful?
It's always good, I found, to be able to answer I don't know to at least one question, and we did not look internationally. I'm not personally aware of any freight-specific infrastructure bank, but I think particularly in Western Europe, there's greater central government involvement in advancing infrastructure investment than in the U.S.
Okay. Well, we'll move on to some questions now for Bruce and Ed, but please feel free to continue typing in questions for any of the presenters, and we'll also, if you have time, open the phone lines at the end. Let's see, I'm going to start at the top, Bruce and Ed, with the questions for you. Why haven't more multi-state coalitions like I-95 been formed?
I think one of the reasons is dedicated funding, that there's a desire to get together, and we see them form over time, come together ad hoc for a project, but the ability to maintain that momentum has been somewhat of a struggle.
Well, I think, to add on to that, if you think of these as the historical development of the MPOs, and the first decade of those, there was some federal special urban studies in the largest cities, because it was begun to be realized that we needed something that took a look at metropolitan areas as a whole. And those gradually grew into self-organized MPO-type things. There were regional planning commissions and so on around that took on transportation roles and gradually developed. But it wasn't until in the 60s and then more formally in the 70s that there was any consistent funding for those kinds of organizations. Now that there's been consistent funding for quite a few years and an actual requirement that you don't get your federal grant money unless you have an MPO in a metropolitan area, we have 384. So I think it's more a question of institutional development over a period of time, natural evolution. We have 20 of these things. And they're all pretty big, so it's not an insignificant movement already, but it's self-initiated. And there's not much support, so they have to want it strongly enough to support it themselves, by and large. That could be changed by an intentional federal program that would sponsor those kinds of organizations.
This is Mike Williamson. I'm going to respond to that as well, Jennifer.
Sure.
If you think about when the I-95 corridor coalition was created, the Gary Chicago Milwaukee GCM corridor was created at the same time, and they had very different evolutions. And I-95 is still there, going strong, and the GCM corridor has kind of gone away in large part due to funding and kind of I think lack of a strong desire by those folks to keep it going, but primarily funding. There's also the West Coast Corridor Coalition, which was started a year or two ago, which is struggling to get up and running to provide a similar type coalition on the west coast of the U.S. And to date, I think they are still, I don't know if anyone is on the line who's involved in that, but to some degree that has struggled as well to get up and going. And I think being the I-95 has been successful because it's been successful at getting dedicated funding, and it's also been very successful in showing strong commitment from its member states and progress over time.
Well, it may also go back to the need for a champion. Who champions multi-state things? Usually not governors, usually not legislators. Who? Well, it's kind of, you need your champions coming from the national level, probably, or just rely on a natural leader coming up in an individual case. And I think that's kind of a little more where we are at this stage of evolution.
Okay. Do you ever envision the I-95 coalition signing a concession agreement with each state to operate and maintain I-95 from Florida to Maine?
We're very lucky to have with us Mary Grace Parker from the I-95 Corridor Coalition, so I'm going to ask if she could answer that.
I think my short answer would be no. That would be the short answer. And I think I'll step back and answer the question before this, and I think that'll tell you why. The evolution of the coalition really started out of one of the things you need to form a coalition, and that strong leadership and champions and strong will. And so, and then a strong purpose for people to come around to organize. And clearly in the early 90s, it was strong leadership by people like Emil Frankel and Hal Kassoff and John Schaefer, who was up in New York, who saw a clarity and a need for agencies to come together for coordination. And that time in an operational role, it was the early deployment of ITS following ICE-T. There was a lot of issues regarding systems operation with respect to impact on highway systems whether they were planned or unplanned events. And so the purpose is really what started it, and along with the leadership and a little bit of initial funding that came out of that ICE-T legislation. I think what's allowed it to grow and continue has been as the issues have evolved, whether it's policy, planning, looking at freight, moving across, looking at just highways and looking at transportation as a system. The key is that the state agencies realize that their boundaries are not the boundaries for things like freight, for events such as major accidents, nor in the congestion impacts that relate to them, nor when it comes to policy and planning initiatives, particularly when you start to look at things like freight. Freight doesn't have one particular home. It moves between locations. And so the ability to have that type of an organization where they could come, look at these issues, work on policy issues, start to talk about how do you finance mega projects, where do those benefits accrue, make that a healthy type of environment to have those dialogues. At the same time, it continues because frankly it's not a threatening environment. Coalition is an entity that's looking to operate or maintain the very systems that those parties are coming and operate. So as people have their own sense of self-direction, of self-ownership, a coalition allows you an opportunity to come and look without beyond your boundaries, look at issues, share best practices, share information, determine what you need to work on together that you can leverage without losing the autonomy you have at a strong state home rule type environment or practice.
Thank you. On the institutional options slide, how come so few of the examples were interstate highway oriented?
Well, I'll let Bruce give a more thorough answer, but I think where you did see the interstate highway were the voluntary coalitions at 20 or so that he mentioned, but the nature of how the interstate system is funded and was built with the formula funds from federal aid really to the states really didn't require some of these other mechanisms that other modes of transportation have needed to develop.
Well, I could just add that the federal government from time to time has exercised fairly major amounts of leadership. And for the interstate highway system, the president called for that as the Eisenhower Initiative. And once your president is behind an idea, the federal agency gets behind it. Wasn't a federal thing only, but the feds had a real incentive then to pull the states together and to work on the design of a system. So it was a collaborative design, as I understand it, but it came from federal initiatives. A little bit like the Amtrak and the Conrail things, somewhat different origins, but nevertheless federal leadership. In the roundtable that we called together to go over my paper, one of the surprising conclusions, I thought, was almost unanimous agreement that it is time now for more federal leadership. And not only multi-state, but intermodal. I think one of the questions a little farther down the list is, why not more about federal intermodal? It's been tried several times, but very tentatively and then kind of fallen into disuse. I think our roundtable group was pretty strong in believing that it's time for the feds to do more on intermodal coordination than they have been doing recently. So the federal leadership waxes and wanes depending on times and conditions and the political scene. But it's there are plenty of precedents for bringing federal leadership back into a stronger position.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll do one more question for Bruce and Ed, and then we'll move on to a few questions for Mike in the interest of time. So the next question for Bruce and Ed, did your research daylight any lessons learned about the effectiveness of long-running institutional arrangements? Do they get better over time, stay the same, or deteriorate?
No, we were not really evaluating individual organizations. There was one study that had been done, a rather brief study, that took a look at it and concluded that there is an evolution, essentially through those three stages that Williamson talked about, and noting that very few ever make the jump into type three. When you start off as a coalition, you tend to sort of stay as a coalition. there's a self-perpetuation about that form of organization. You have a board of directors, and the board of directors sort of stays on the same, we're here to help, we're not here to take over, sort of. That's the grease that keeps the coalition together. When you start stepping into making hard choices and taking votes and making enemies, the coalition does not have the kind of strength to withstand that. I think if you go back to Mary Grace's answer a couple minutes ago on do you expect the I-95 corridor coalition to take on a more active decision and funding and implementation role, I think the answer for anyone working in one of those organizations would be the same that Mary Grace gave. That's the kind of dynamics you have in that sort of an organization.
And this is Mike Williamson. I'd like to add a few things.
Sure.
But when you look at the purpose behind a institutional arrangement and its ability to evolve over time, I think really dictates the longevity of the arrangement and whether or not the need for it continues. And certainly the I-95 example has been shown as one that works and has maintained and has continued to serve a purpose. And you look at some others, just to throw out an example, in Washington State, the Freight Mobility Strategic Investment Board, PHMSA, was created and funded by the legislature prior to there being an Office of Freight within the DOT, because the legislature recognized that there needed to be investments in the freight transportation system. So they set aside some funding and created this strategic investment board to allocate that funding. Over the next several years, the DOT reorganized and created their Office of Freight, which has then stepped up and provided the statewide freight planning and programming elements. So now PHMSA has had to refocus kind of what it's doing and complement, so that the DOT and PHMSA are complementing each other. And they've both remained intact and both remained successful, but it has involved new realms of coordination and objectives for that particular example. And when you look at some others, when a lot of MPOs back in the mid-90s first started getting into freight transportation planning, they would set up freight transportation advisory committees as part of their freight plan to advise the study and to help set the basic platform for the region's freight program. And in some cases, those advisory committees were transitioned into official advisory committees for the MPO board, providing monthly reports to them on what they're doing. And in other cases, they kind of fell away based on lack of motivation to actually keep the folks attending the meeting. So it really does, I think, impact the longevity, and whether they get better or get worse or stay the same really is based on the leadership, the need for the arrangement, and whether it can evolve over time.
Okay, thank you. Mike, there's one question for you, so I think we'll go ahead and address that now, and then we'll be about out of time. Mike, the question is, it looks like a natural evolution is to go from tier 1 to 2 to 3. How much time transpires typically? At the end of the day, we are all interested in developing a funded project.
Okay, thanks. As I pointed out in my presentation, there's a natural progression from type 1 to 2 to 3, particularly for those arrangements that need to be a type 3. They need to go through the type 1 and the type 2 to get to the type 3, because without that foundation, the type 3 is going to struggle. But there are plenty of type 1s that only evolve as far as type 2s, and there are plenty of type 1s that stay at type 1. It's really based on the objective. And I don't think everybody is looking for every arrangement to result in funded projects. That's not to say that the goal of all arrangements is not to support the overall funding and investment in the freight transportation system, but there's different roles. If your role is to provide education and outreach and build an understanding and promote the importance of freight, that's going to lead to other folks championing, whether it be elected officials or government direct, you know, the directors or of MPOs and secretaries of transportation to prioritize, but the sole purpose of a particular advisory group may be to build that. So in cases of how long it takes, my understanding, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the Alameda Corridor Transportation Authority went through the evolution very quickly. Very quickly from the perspective of what they accomplished. I mean, it took several years to get from, well, decades to go from where they were to where they, but once they actually got the mechanisms in place, they moved fairly quickly, and it was all with the idea of getting to the Type 3 place.
Okay, thank you. We're about out of time. I think there's one or two questions that we didn't get a chance to address, and what I'll do is send those out to the presenters, and then when I send the follow-up information to everybody online, I'll make sure to include the just a written response to those questions. I want to thank all presenters for a very interesting seminar today, and thank you for everybody in attendance. Again, the recording, the presentations, and a transcript will be posted online within the next week or so, and I'll send an email out when it becomes available. If you didn't register in advance and you do want to receive the follow-up information, if you could just send me an email so I have your contact information. And also, if you logged in today using a different name than you used to register, if you can just let me know what you registered under, that would help me out when I send up the follow-up. The next seminar will be held on October 21st and will be about the Panama Canal widening and implementations for Gulf and Atlantic Coast ports. The link to register is shown on the slide on your screen right now. Also, we're starting to collect topics for the 2010 seminar series, and if you have any ideas for topics or presenters, go ahead and email them to me, and I'll forward them on to the Federal Highway Administration. You can also type them in the chat box here. This screen will remain up even after the seminar is over. I also encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv if you haven't already done so, and all future seminars are announced through the listserv. So with that, we'll close out for today. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Mary Grace, for joining in today, and have a great rest of the day.